Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours. Hello, friends, and welcome to Issue 11 of Protecting Project Pulp, the podcast that whispers to you from the deep, dark past, with tales from the golden age of pulp fiction, where nearly every genre of the world began. I'm your host, Dave Robison. And this week, we're pleased to unlock yet another genre indicative of the pulpish vibe, horror. Specifically, one of the most subtle and chilling facets of the horror genre, the ghost story. This week's tale is titled A Voice from the Fog by Ben Ames Williams and was first published in All Story Magazine on September 15, 1917. Remember that year, 1917, as you listen to the story. It might help provide a little context in terms of the world in which the story takes place. All Story Magazine is one of those iconic pulp mags of the era. Though it only published through 1920, when it was absorbed by the mighty Argosy magazine, it published stories from some of the greats of the pulp era, including Rex Stout's Nero Wolfe stories, Johnston McCulley's Zorro tales, and Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan of the Apes. Ben Ames Williams was an accomplished American writer, writing hundreds of short stories and over 30 novels during the course of his career. He was most often read in the Saturday Evening Post, which, for Ames and his peers, was the gold standard and a vindication of skill as a writer. Interestingly, it was his poor handwriting that set the wheels in motion for his writing career. As the story goes, after Ames graduated college, he was offered a teaching position. He was uncertain whether or not he should take it, so he telegraphed his father seeking career advice. But Ames's handwriting was so horrible, his father mistook the word teaching for traveling. Not wanting his son to become a traveling salesman, he advised against taking the position. Ames heeded his father's unintentional wisdom and took a job reporting for the Boston American, a daily tabloid newspaper. Your narrator for this chilling bit of Americana is Nobilis Reed, a gifted voiceover artist and talented storyteller in his own right, with several novels, many short stories, and a couple of anthologies under his belt. He's lent his voice to numerous audio fiction productions, including J. Daniel Sawyer's Predestination and Down from Ten, Starla Hutchton's The Dreamer's Thread, and Paulette Jackson's The Empress Sword. Okay then, turn down the lights and settle back. And those plans you had for going out on the lake this evening, you might want to cancel them. Something happened out there. Maybe it's still happening. But it's not good, and it's not safe.
A Voice from the Fog by Ben Ames Williams. A Different Story. The sun climbed high above the pines that topped the rocky heights along the eastern shore of the lake, and the fish lost their appetite. But if they were no longer hungry, we were. William turned the boat toward camp, and we landed at the flat rock like a landing stage below our tent. I cradled a handful of birch bark and a few twigs into a crackling little blaze, and had a pot of coffee boiling by the time William had split four of our morning's catch of bass. Half-pounders they were, not trophies of which I should boast when I returned to civilization, but toothsome nevertheless. Spitted on green twigs, the fish turned from pink to white and then to golden brown, as we broiled them in the flames. The coffee had a pine woods aroma all its own, the bass were beyond compare, and only William's wife Annie could make such donuts as those he produced from the basket in the tent door. When the last white bone was picked, we doused our fire with water splashed from the lake, lit each his pipe, and found a spot where a spreading hemlock let the climbing sun warm a flat rock, just enough and not too much. It was lazy weather in late September, a a sky without clouds, and a placid lake that rippled to the caress of each whisper of wind as a cat's fur rippled to the hand that strokes it. The morning mist had gone where good mists go, a suggestion of it yet remaining, so that the lake seemed to steam lazily in the sun. I said to Williams, lazily, "I'm going to take a swim in an hour or so." William puffed slowly at his pipe and for a time said nothing. "I used to be a right smart swimmer when I was a boy," he remarked at last, almost as though it were a confession. "Ain't cared much for swimming these last few years, though." I was moved to an oration on the joys of swimming. I spoke at length and with feeling, though not too much feeling, for it was more pleasant not to exert oneself unduly. "Greatest of sports," I orated. "Nothing like it. No sensation to equal floating along." "Accolade, that's right," William agreed, with what was almost a hint of impatience in his voice. "But there's things that a man can't stand. I sort of got put out of the notion of swimming here a while back." I looked at William from the corner of an eye and saw a story in his face. And so I made myself as small and as quiet as possible and left William to address himself to his bubbling pipe and to the dimpling lake and to the fair September morning. "Yes, sir," Williams repeated. "I was a good swimmer. Never saw but one that could beat me at it. And that is a woman." And so he began. "You know," said William, "that there used to be a summer camping ground up on Round Pond, 10-12 miles northeast of here. There's quite a bunch of folks that come there, regular, every year. But they don't come no more. The lake don't look as pretty to them now as it did then, maybe. I used to own a farm up that way myself, but I sort of moved away after a spell and bought down here. It was Nick Radiman's drowning that seemed to set folks agin the place, and Lander Gipper's finish put the finish to the summer camping, too. I can recollect the first time I ever took particular notice of this Nick Radiman. He used to be a kind of handyman around the camp. The cottages and tents was set on a slope amongst the pines, and I used some boating and take 'em fishing and carry their truck into the camp from the railroad north of here. So naturally I was down there right smart, and this day I took note of Nick Radiman was the day they was all in swimming. It was right at the start of the season, and there was some of the new ones I didn't know yet, but right away I spotted this woman by the raft, and gentleman, but she could swim. The rest of the crowd was watching her do stunts, and I didn't blame them a mite. She was worth watching. She was laughing, and they kept egging her on to do new tricks of one kind and another, and she'd do whatever they said. I see her do two dives that was as smooth as the sun dipping behind the trees. She'd go down from the top of the raft ladder as straight and slim and supple as a piece of steel that's tempered just right. And the water, it seemed like it reached right up to meet her. It just took her right down into the lake like a lover takes his girl. This little quiver of her, she slipped down out of sight, was for all the world like a way a girl seems to pretend to hold back when her boy holds out his arms to her. There ain't many things any prettier than a pretty dive, now is there? I was out on a rocky point to one side, watching her. I forgot pretty near everything just seeing this woman perform. She was just a girl, you'd say at first, not over 20, surely. And then the next minute, you'd be sure she was a woman grown and no girl at all. And then one of the men challenged her to a race, and they div off the raft and started toward the point where I was. She struck right into the crawl, smooth as clockwork. And her arms had come up, left one up a little, right a little higher, then right one high and left not quite so high. You know how I mean. The stroke never lost one beat of time, nor varied an inch in the reach and the drive of them. And she made the fellow racing her look like he was standing still, so that he gave up and laughed and turned back to the raft, and she stopped and went after him and beat him back to it. After that, they all took to diving for white pebbles, and this woman beating them all. Once she stayed underwater extra long, and I heard someone give a gasp right behind me. But shucks, I felt that same way myself, and I didn't even turn round to see who it was. And then, a minute later, this girl woman climbed the ladder on the raft and waved her hand to them and div off and didn't come up. When she'd been down 30 seconds, I began to watch for her pretty close. And when I figured she'd been under close on a minute, I started to edge toward the water, not knowing what I'd do, but just to be on hand. When she'd been down something over a minute, I heard the man behind me speak out. It sounded like the words that was choked out of him, like you squeeze a seed out of a cherry, and I wheeled like a shot. "My God!" was all he said, and that ain't so awful much to say, maybe. But the way he said it and the look on his face told me he was scared to the edge of nothing.
A nice set-up man he was, with clean skin and a good clear eye. He didn't see me looking at him, just stared past me at the water, leaning forward a bit. And then there come a little splash and a gasp behind me. I turned, and there was the woman just climbing out on the rocks at our feet. She'd swum all that way to the rocks from the raft underwater. It must have been around 5-6 rods. "Hello, Nick," she called out to the man behind me. "I saw you and came over." He was too paralyzed to reach a hand out to help her up the rock, but she didn't need help. She swung them up and took his hand, not seeming to notice the scared face of him. I hadn't had a real good look at her before this, but she passed right by me now, and I see she surely was built pretty. She was breathing deep, and you could see her sides swell clear down to the tip of her lungs with each breath. No wonder, breathing like that, she could stay under as she liked. Straight she was, and when she walked there was a ripple to her from her throat to her toe. Through wet bathing clothes you could see the swell of her chest and the flexing of her thigh muscles as she climbed the rocks. Most women you see in their bathing suits, there's some part of them, a skinniness or a fatness or a flatness in the wrong place, that spoils the picture. But this woman, if you'd only seen a part of her as big as your hand, you'd have known every bit of her was perfect. Animals are that way. The average woods animal is finished smooth to the last knothole, but there ain't many humans that don't look better for keeping most of themselves under cover. This woman was perfect as a doe or a catamount. There was something about her, too, even that first day, that made me think of a catamount. She went along with this man that had been so scared, the one she'd called Nick, and I saw them go to their cabin up among the pines. Folks told me about her when I asked. The man was Nick Radiman, and she was Helen Radiman, his wife. Radiman and his partner, Leander Gipper, was at the camp that summer for the first time. There was an idea that Radiman had been a clerk or something, and had married her when she had money. That was what folks said. The thing they didn't tell me about Radiman, because they didn't know it, even if I had begun to figure it out for myself, was that he was scared of the water. You never caught him in swimming, and if he went fishing, which he did, it was because his partner, this Gipper, pestered him into it. I've been out with him, and I've seen Gipper tip the boat just to see Radiman shiver and grab the thwarts. You think you wouldn't have no use for a man that was scared of water that way, but you couldn't help liking Radiman. I knew he wasn't a coward, for one thing, for I saw Gipper snag him in the thumb with a hook one day, and Radiman whipped out his knife and cut the thing out without a whimper. He was a friendly sort of a man, and he wasn't afraid of his share of the work that went with good times. He was just folks, like the rest of us, not the kind that slaps you on the back every little while, like Gipper, but you liked him just the same. Now, you take Gipper, and it was different, and that was a right funny thing, too. I always figured Lander Gipper was like an egg that's been kept just a day too long. If he wasn't addled, there was a musty streak in him somewhere. He was always smiling, for one thing. And if there's anything sorrowfuler than a man that never smiles, it's a man that's always smiling. Gipper's smile wasn't right pleasant anyhow. It looked to me like his collar was choking him. His eyes stuck out a little, too. There was something about him I couldn't put a name to. It made me fidget like a nervous girl. It was a funny pair of partners, and I studied him right smart, and Mrs. Radiman, too. There was a woman, and as wrapped up in Nick Radiman as a hen with one chick. His being scared of water and her loving it so naturally worried her, and she used to try to get him to learn to swim, but there wasn't a chance. Her and me got right friendly after a spell, and she talked to me about Nick in a way to make you cry. It always struck me as sort of pitiful, some way, the way things as fine as women themselves all tied up with us men. But I reckon they're built so they can't help it. Helen Radiman was more that way than most, too. She was a mother and a wife and a sister and a chum and a lot of other things to Radiman, all at once. She told me one day that his being scared of water come from his father being drowned, and his mother always warning him of the water when he was a baby and a kid. I always figured Gipper and Radiman would have a blow-up as partners someday, and it come late that summer in the camp. The inside of it I never knew, but I know I'd drive a man in from the railroad to see them, and I left them together on a rock below the cabins, and I come past a little later, and they were at it. Both of them were mad, and Gipper's eyes was as hateful as a snake's. I heard Radiman say, "Well, pay this man's bill. Pay him what's due him, or I'll show you up before the whole city." I went on past, and after a bit I saw the stranger head back for the railroad and one of the other teams, and he looked to be satisfied. The next afternoon it was that I took Gipper and Radiman out trolling. They seemed to have patched things up a bit, but I noticed Gipper was studying Radiman, like he was picking out a place to hit. We got back to camp, and Mrs. Radiman was waiting for us at the slip, all cool and purty in some white dress she'd put on for the evening. We come alongside the slip, and I got out and held the boat while Gipper stepped up beside me. Radiman was half standing up in the boat, and Gipper, in stepping out, happened to give the thwart a kick, and the boat tipped. Well, Radiman went all to pieces. He dropped flat in the boat and hugged onto his seat, and his face was gray with fright. There wasn't 3 feet of water under him, either. Maybe it was funny, though it didn't strike me so. Gipper laughed till he cried. "By the Lord, Nick," he yelled, "I'm going to make you learn to swim yet. I'm going to take you out in the canoe some day and tip you over. You'll swim then, I'll bet a fortune." At that, things got all mighty quiet of a sudden. Radiman climbed down on the slip, moving careful, and I saw Radiman had her eye on Gipper. Wouldn't have liked it much to have her look at me like that. I looked his way to see how he took it. Gipper wasn't noticing. He looked like a man that had just heard a hail off in the woods somewhere, or like a fellow that had just remembered something important. And I saw his eyes flash toward Radiman, and there was something in them raging like trapped snake that twists and squirms and strikes at everything in reach. And then Radiman and his wife went to the cabin, and Gipper went off along the rocks by himself. The next day it was that Radiman got drowned. Him and Gipper had planned to go fishing at dawn, and me being up early like I always am, I was down to the slip when they put out. Misty it was, like most times in the morning on main lakes. They come down to the slip together, and Radiman started to put their truck into a boat, but Gipper stopped him. "Put the truck in a canoe," he cried. "I'm not going to go rattling those oars all over the lake, scaring the bass to death." Radiman started to argue it, then changed his mind. He hated like time to admit how he felt about the water, and hid it all he could. Gipper could fairly raise welts on him with his jeers. Radiman had on a gray flannel shirt, I recollect, and had on a white handkerchief tied around his head. He had a headache when he started out, Ms. Radiman told me after. I offered to go along with him and handle the canoe, but Gipper put me down. "Damn it, don't butt in," he says. So they paddled away, Gipper in the stern, and was lost in the fog before they passed the swimming raft off the slip. I didn't see Radiman again till I dragged up his body 2 days later. I was still down to the slip when Gipper came back alone, and I knew without his telling me what had happened. He was wet, he'd been in the lake, and there was some water in the canoe. You know how a canoe will do that way, tip a man out and scarcely wet its own bottom at all. I ran to help Gipper pull the canoe up, and I says, "Where's Mr. Radiman?" "We upset," he says. "He tried to turn around in his seat and tipped us both out. He went down like a rock, he's drowned." I couldn't say anything, but I just looked at him. He looked like a pale frog that had just had an awful scare. Yes, sir, that's just what he looked like. Made me feel a mite sick to look at him. He was a good swimmer, but I figured he'd been too scared to dive for Radiman. He went to his cabin, and I was about to go away, knowing that someone would have to tell Mrs. Radiman, and not wanting to be the man, when I heard Rimble's canoe coming. Shucks, now, I ain't told you about Rimble, have I? I always do get things mixed up when I try to tell a straight story. Listen, then. This Eugene Rimble was one of the men in the camp, an oldish man, kind of an invalid, a chap that liked to stay by himself and paddle around the lake in his own canoe, alone, and so on. He told me his heart was bad. He was taking things easy for fear of shock of some kind. Well, I heard this other canoe coming, and I see it was Rimble's, and him in it. And then I forgot all about Radiman, for I see Rimble needed help more and quicker. He couldn't hardly paddle. He was weaving in his seat and zigzagging toward the slip, and his face was all torn and drawn into wrinkles like someone had gone over it with a rake. His eyes were popping, and the worst of it was he was laughing. I hate to hear a man laugh like that. I gave a hail, and Bill Waite and Guy Falkley, that worked around the camp like me, come running down to the water as Rimble's canoe beached. He tried to step out, and his knees buckled, and he dropped on his face in the shallow, short water. We carried him up to his tent, and while the rest of the camp was thinking and talking about the news Gipper had brought, we worked to revive Rimble. He did come round at last, enough to tell us what had happened. He said he'd heard Radiman drown. Heard was the word he used. He said he'd paddled out to the ledge, 2-3 miles from camp and near the wild shore across the lake, and had just started to fish a little when he heard another canoe off in the fog. You know how sound carries that way. He couldn't tell how far off this other canoe was, but he said he heard voices and talking. And then he heard a sudden clatter, and a voice that he recognized as Radiman's yelled, "Gipper, for God's sake, look out! He'll tip us over!" Then there was no answer to that, Rimble said, but just another kind of choky yell, and a splash, and the scrape of a paddle falling over a canoe thwart. And he knew they'd upset. Rimble was a sick little cuss, and he never thought to go help them, just sat and listened. His story isn't easy to get, for he was fighting us and trying to get out of bed, but he did say he heard Radiman yell, "Hold the canoe, for God's sake, so I can keep up." Then he said there came a sort of a gurgle. Rimble said that gurgling was the worst. And then Radiman again, "Help! Gipper!" And then nothing more for a while. And then the noise of a man swimming, and a paddle rattling in a canoe. And after a bit, the noise of a man paddling away. And Rimble said he started back for the camp, and that was about all he could tell us. Fockley had gone for the doctor first off, but Dr. Hughes, the only one in camp, was out with the others, hunting for Radiman, and before Fockley could paddle across the lake and get him, Rimble up and died. Heart cracked on him, the doctor said.
"They told me the first thing Mrs. Radiman said when she heard was, Leander Gipper killed him. Me, I didn't hardly think she was right, in spite of what Rimble had said. Rimble was a sick man, half dead. He'd heard them tip over and heard Radiman drown. And that was bad enough to upset any man, so he wouldn't be too sure of what Radiman had yelled. He'd rambled all over the lot in telling it to us, and it wasn't even as straight out as I've given it to you. Doc Bransford, a district attorney, came up to camp to see about it and talked to me. I told him what Rimble had said. He felt like I did. You couldn't count on a sick man hearing straight on a thing like that. He said how you couldn't get that story before a jury anyhow. We got Radiman's body, and there isn't a mark on it. So though there was some talk about Gipper doing it, he wasn't even arrested, and the whole thing seemed to just drop. Mrs. Radiman took Nick Radiman's body and the clothes he had worn that last day and went home. Guy Fockley drove her up to the railroad. She said goodbye to me at the camp, and just as she was getting into Guy's wagon, Gipper came up and said something and put out his hand. She didn't speak to him, but just looked in his eyes and then down at his hand, and he jerked it back like she had stuck a knife into it. And then she drove away. Looking after her and at Gipper, I said to myself, 'Bill Place,' I says, 'there'll be another chapter of this story yet.' And there was, stranger than the first, and it was this that stopped the campers coming to the lake. It was the next summer. The crowd didn't begin to come to the camp, take it as a usual thing, till along in June. Jim Waite owned the place, and he'd made a good thing out of it for several seasons. He built a big dining hall, a sort of lodge where folks could get together on rainy days besides the cabins, tents scattered through the trees. The next summer after Radiman was drowned, along the middle of May, Jim sent for me. 'Bill,' he says, 'I want you to start in early this season. That man Gipper is sick, and he wants to come here early. I've agreed, and I want you to take care of him. The cook won't be here till 1st of June, so you'll have to cook for him and take him around.' 'I didn't figure he'd come here again,' I says. 'Tell you straight, I'd as soon he didn't,' said Jim, 'but I don't like to refuse him. So I agreed to take care of Leander Gipper, and when he came, I met him at the station and carried him over my team. I saw right away that he was a medium sick man, like Jim had said. He looked right poorly. It's a funny thing, but folks seem to like to tell me their troubles. I bet I've heard more secrets than a doctor, and so I wasn't what you'd call surprised when Gipper got confidential, first time we went out after bass. When we started, I'd headed the boat up the lake, but he says, 'No, let's go across to the ledge.' So I done like he said. I'd only figured he wouldn't want to fish where Radiman had been drowned. That was at the ledge. There was just as good fishing up the lake. What we called the ledge was a place where big rocks on the bottom of the lake was piled up to within 10 or 15 feet of the surface, and with sand from them to the nearest, a great place for fish. It was Gipper that started the conversation, after we'd finished a while with nothing doing. 'I suppose you're surprised I came back this year,' he says. 'Not in particular,' I tells him. 'This is a right nice place to come to.' 'But after last year,' he begins, and I cut in on him. 'Accidents can happen anywhere,' I says. He thought that over for a while before he said anything more. 'I didn't intend to come,' he says at last, and then he let go of himself a little. 'I didn't want to ever see the place again,' he says, in a hoarse kind of way. 'But I won't be scared out,' he says. That didn't seem to call for me to say anything, so I didn't say it. 'I won't be scared,' he says again. 'Nobody,
Nothing can scare me away. And then he whisked around to look over his shoulder as if he expected someone to hit him.
Why should you be scared? I says. Just to be talking. And at that he whips out a letter and hands it to me. Look at that, he tells me. It wasn't rightly a letter. You've seen these calendar pads with a date at the top and a place to write below. It was a sheet torn off of one of them, and it says, I'll expect you at the ledge this summer. And it was just signed, Nick. Nick, I says, feeling the flesh on my cheeks crawl a little. Who's that? He leaned toward me. Radiman, he says. He used to leave notes like that on my desk when we were to meet anywhere, and he had missed me. That's his writing, I'll swear it. But where'd this come from, I says. He looked around, and as though afraid anyone might hear. There's been one like that on my desk every Tuesday morning this winter, he told me. Always the same words, always in Radiman's hand, always on a Tuesday morning. And I've had detectives, and never yet succeeded in finding how the thing gets there. Always on a Tuesday morning, man. Don't you understand? It was a Tuesday morning when Radiman was drowned. I gave Gipper back his note. I was glad to. Well, things went along, and the other campers began to get there, and nothing happened, and Gipper chirked up some. I got him off my hands, me having other jobs to attend to. He didn't make friends much, but he'd go off fishing by himself all morning, around the lake, and in the evening he'd be out again. He went out one morning, so, in the mist about sunup, it was a Tuesday. I seen him go, but I didn't think nothing of it. I was working around the camp, like I always was, and in about an hour I heard some coming like mad across the lake, and they weren't paddling quiet or careful, neither. So I watched, and it was Gipper, and he had had an awful scare. I helped him up to land, and I had to all but carry him to his tent. He wouldn't tell me a word, but he stayed in his tent all that day. And when I tried to take him some dinner, he raved at me and told me to get away, which I did. I wondered some about that, but I set it down to nerves or something, for Gipper had come to camp in a bad way, and I reckoned he weren't cured yet. But a week after he come to me, and he says, "Will you take me trolling tomorrow morning, Bill?" he says. I figured, "Tomorrow's Tuesday, ain't it?" "Sure, I ain't got a date for tomorrow. Start early?" He nodded, didn't say a word, just went on to his tent. And 'twan't till 'twas too late that I remembered that Tuesday was sort of a Jonah day for him. I could have backed out then, and I would have, if there'd been anything to back out for. But there wasn't no excuse I could make, so I let things go along. So we met down to the shore next morning, and when it was just coming light, he stowed his stuff in the stern of the boat, and I took the oars, and I asked him, "Where'll we go?" "The ledge," he says. "Row back and forth across the ledge." And I see then that his face was white, and he was gritting his teeth to keep them from chattering. "Cold?" I says. "No," he snaps at me. "Don't bother about me, Bill. There's a fish over the ledge I'm going to get, or it'll get me." So we rowed over, and rowed back and forth, and in and out, part of the time not 100 yards from shore, part of the time further out. Me, rowing, had my back to the front, and Gipper was trolling over the stern. But he didn't seem to put his mind to it. He missed 2 or 3 good strikes by jerking too soon. Finally, I says to him, "Watch your line closer, and you'll have better luck." He started to say something, changed his mind, and for a spell he kept his eyes on his line. Then he got to looking around the boat, ahead again, and then all of a sudden the hair stood up on the back of my head, for I saw Gipper turn a sickly white. "Listen," he whispers in a sort of chalky voice, "hear that?" I listened. Not with the chuckling of the little waves and all, it was easy to think I heard something. But the next minute I knew there weren't nothing to hear. "Hear what?" I asked him, looking all around. I'd stopped rowing. There was mist on the water, and we couldn't see much. But I knew where we was, on the inside of the ledge, not far offshore. He didn't say nothing more, and I looked at him. Then I see his lips were moving fast, like he was trying to tell me something. He was looking past me across the water, and his mouth going that away. Then, all of a sudden, he yells, "For God's sake, did you hear that man? Choking, splashing." He mouthed something I couldn't hear. Then, "Row, pull ahead," he yelled, and pointed over my shoulder.
I looked that way. There was something, just a flash of white, and something gray lifting off in the mist. Maybe it were a touch of white foam on a lifting little wave. But when Radiman was drowned, you recollect, he had a white handkerchief around his head, and he was wearing a gray flannel shirt. I was paralyzed for a spell, and then Gipper let out a scream. "Hear that?" he yells. "Hear him calling! Help! Gipper!" I lunged on my oars, and I swung around as I'd done it, and I ain't ashamed to say that we made time back to camp. And Gipper in the stern begging me to hurry to go back, and then begging me to hurry to camp, and then dropping forward in the boat to cry in his arms like a sick baby. I hated the man. You've seen a spider, half smashed with a broken leg or something, wriggling around, and you know how there'll come something surging up in you to make you set your heel on the ugly squirming thing and grind it into the dirt. That's how I felt toward Gipper. He was sweating, and I felt like his sweat was the poison coming out of him. My nose and my eyes and my ears was sick from smelling and seeing and hearing him. It was like I was getting in the way of the workings of somebody outside the world. I felt like Gipper had been marked and set apart to take that which was coming to him, and I didn't want no part in it. When we landed, and he staggered up the slope to his tent, I took and upset the boat in the lake and washed it out where he'd been setting. It was my boat, and that show how I felt about Gipper. Maybe I was wrong, but I'd given this the way it happened. Well, Gipper stayed ashore all that week, but something seems to be dragging at him. And come on Monday, he asked me to take him out the next morning. "I can't do it," I told him. "I got other plans." "But I can't go alone," he says, his voice shaking. "And I've got to go." I didn't say no more, and he says, "Please, come along." And I didn't say anything to that neither. So he saw it wasn't no use. And all that day I could see he was trying to make himself go out alone. And he asked some of the others to go with him, but it happened none of them would do it. So Gipper didn't go out the next morning. He stayed in his tent all that day. Nothing happened. But once when I was over that way, I heard someone talking inside his tent. Him, maybe. That evening he'd come up to me. "You ought to have gone out with me," he said in a queer, level tone. "Next week, Tuesday, I must go." I turned around and went away, left him standing there. I reckon I didn't treat that man right, but I was sure now he'd done it to Radiman. And anyway, there was something about him that tasted bitter in my mouth. He was unclean, like a leper. Not but what he washed aplenty, but he seemed that way, if you know what I mean. The next Monday night, a big man come to camp, an old customer named Hodges. He was big and fat and hearty, and crazy for bass. And he was a crank on fishing in the rain. So I started into rain that night, and this Hodges decides he wants to go fishing first crack in the morning. So I was nominated to take him out. It struck me that the next morning would be Tuesday, but there was no way I could get out of it without a fuss. So me and this Hodges got a boat and started out, first crack of day. Gipper hadn't left his tent then. I looked, and I knew. It was raining in steady, slicing streaks that came right down and flailed the water of the lake till little dense drops were a constant cloud along the surface. The rain was warm, and the water itself was steaming in the early morning. It was right comfortable to be out if you was fixed for it. That is, with plenty on or nothing at all. We had rubber boots and oilskins and oilskin hats, and we were dry enough. This Hodges decided it wasn't good weather for trolling, but he'd got some helgamites from the boss before we started. And we tried to hole up the shore before camp. Didn't have no luck, so he says, "Take me across to ledge." That didn't appeal to me. "They ain't biting there like they used to," I says. "But there's a great hole up the lake a ways." "Uh-uh," says Hodges, him being a stubborn citizen. "I got a hunch they'll lead us up over at the ledge." Now, I didn't want to go to the ledge. No more than nothing. And yet I had a sort of sneaking curiosity, too. So I went along, and we started at one end and anchored there a spell, and moved down a little at a time. The rain kept coming down in sluices, and you couldn't hardly see your boat's length, it seemed like. When we got over toward the ledge, I was listening and trying to look around us through the rain. I couldn't help it, and while we was fishing down the length of it, I kept this up, till sure enough there came a noise, a voice, low and queer sounding and familiar somehow. "What's that?" says Hodges, hearing it. "Someone in trouble up there. Row up that way." So I did. Give a couple of shoves with the oars, and all of a sudden, out of the mist and the rain, Gipper appeared. He was in a canoe, about 3-4 rods ahead of us. Hodges see him, too. "Why, he's alone," he says. "Thought I heard him." Gipper sees us, and gives sort of a yell, and stood up in the canoe, and Hodges turns white. "The man's crazy," he says. I sings out, "Hello, Gipper, what's wrong?" And at that he screamed like a woman. "Help, Gipper," he yells. "Oh, God!" And he dove over the side of the canoe and down. In the fog and rain beyond, it seemed like I could see something gray and white. But Hodges yells, "We got to save him. He's crazy." I couldn't stay by and see Gipper drown. If he'd gone down, he hadn't come up yet, even if he was a good swimmer. So I jerked off my coat and hat and boots, and over I went, Hodges shoving the boat over to Gipper's canoe to stand by. I went straight down for the bottom, and I see Gipper in a minute, dim through the water. He was swimming around down there, and he saw me, I guess, for he turned and started to swim away. I had the start, and I grabbed at his arm, and he whipped around there 15 feet underwater and fought me. He shoved and scratched at my face and jerked loose and went up toward the surface, and I went up too for air. Time I got there, water out of my ears and all, he'd gone down again. "He's drowning," Hodges yelled, so I made another try, but this time he got a hold of me. Down in the bottom there, and he was crazy, wild, fought like he'd tear me to pieces. I got all sick inside. This wasn't natural, the way he fought me, and then, all of a sudden, I remembered something. I had on a gray flannel shirt, and my hair was as white then as 'tis now. Couldn't held from white handkerchief, maybe, underwater that way. I thought of that, and then all I wanted was to get away, and I did it somehow. The air and the rain sluicing down felt good when I got to the surface. "You're all cut," Hodges yells. "Did you get him?" "He fought me," I gasps, trying to get my breath back. "I couldn't manage him." He helped me into that boat in a hurry. "He'll come to the surface once more," he says. "Maybe we can grab him then." But Gipper didn't come to the surface, and the story got around. That sort of made folks stay away from the camp. He stopped, as though that were all the story, and I waited. And when he did not continue, I said, "Is that all?" William had allowed his pipe to go out. He lit it again with sober care and nodded. "Yeah," he said. "Yeah, I reckon that's all." I found myself trembling a little. I suppose it was Mrs. Radiman swimming there, calling. William shook his head steadily. "Figured you'd think that," he said. "Figured myself she sent him them notes through the winter. But 'twan't her that called to Gipper from the waters on the ledge." "How do you know?" I persisted. "She might have—" "It 'twan't her," William repeated. "Because when Nick Radiman's baby boy was born to her that April, she died."
You just heard A Voice from the Fog by Ben Ames Williams, narrated by Nobilis Reed. I thought this was a charming, if chilling, tale, and superbly read by Master Reed. The vengeance from beyond the grave theme has played out many times in literature, especially pulp and horror literature, but I found this particular tale to be particularly unsettling. You can hear Williams' Saturday Evening Post pedigree in the prose, and I think that may be the hook for me. It was such a congenial and familiar voice that was telling us the tale, and that made the events being related that much more out of joint and disturbing. That's the insidious nature of ghost stories. They always happen in this very spot, or in some place that's so innocuous that you can imagine it happening in your own neighborhood, maybe on your own street, even in your house. But the thing is, we're surrounded by ghosts all the time. Unless you built your house, someone lived in it before you, right? Someone sat in the room where you eat your dinner, or slept in the room where you sleep now. They may not be dead, but then you never know, do you? But their experiences are imbued into the wood and drywall, their voices imprinted on the paint and wallpaper, Those people may not be there now, but they were, and the echoes of their life continues while you go about yours. If you think that's creepy, consider this. That house or apartment you used to live in, someone else is living there now, which means you are their ghost. We leave traces of our lives wherever we go, and the echoes of our joy and sadness continue long past our hearing and awareness. The world is a tangled webwork of new lives built upon the old ones, intersecting and knotting and clustering until the noise of the past is just faint static we've chosen to ignore. Now, each week, Protecting Project Pulp is brought to you by a team of the finest revenants and ghouls of audio fiction. Fred Heimbaugh, our feral assistant editor, stalks the literary graveyards, his ghoulish senses sharp for the scent of fresh pulp, to dig up and return to our fetid lair, that we then dress up in its best finery for your enjoyment, of course. Tom O'Dwyer is our sound engineer, descended of the ancient Banshee, who, as you are well aware, have a thing for sound. His senses are equally pitched to the knife edge of perfection, savaging unwholesome sounds and ensuring only the purest harmonies reach your ears. And Tony Smith, our editor and producer, he is the dark master of the shadowed realms, his piercing gaze revealing every wonder and horror for his personal delight. We hope you found this week's tale to your liking. And remember, there's no need to root around in old pulp graveyards, digging amid the graves of vintage pulp tales. That's our job. All you have to do is subscribe to us on iTunes or at our website, www.protectingprojectpulp.com. And while you're there, feel free to join the other listeners in adding your comments to the post or in our forums. This podcasting thing is a lonely business, and we love hearing that you're out there and what you think of the show. Next week, we bring you a tale of Native American adventure by C. Hall Thompson, titled The Eagle of Kauai. Until then, I wish you only the finest adventures. I'll see you next week. This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.